The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. And that's GSUGGSinsurance.com. Today's issue of Time Magazine is new, August 23/August 30, 2021. Typically, it has a red border on the front cover, with Time in large whitish block letters, superimposed upon a darker background that blends from black to brown to brownish gray, in front of which stand four astronauts, apparently. There are two women and two men. Let's see. I don't find any credit for that photograph. But they have flight suits on. They're dark. They're black. And one of them says, Dr. something Proctor. They have name tags on. One says Jared Rook, perhaps Isaacman or Isaacs. There are U.S. flags on the sleeve, on the left sleeve of each of these individuals. So I'm not sure what they are, but it says 3 days that could change humanity and watch Time's countdown, inspiration for mission to space. Now, that may be what this photograph pertains to. It's on Netflix. I'm going to begin, however, with a page with a couple of brief items. One is entitled Conversation Behind the Scenes. It depicts a man standing in a rather gloomy setting. The photo is black and white, but actually it's in mostly tones of gray. And the man is bearded with, I'm going to say, grayish or perhaps grayish blondish brown hair, since the photo's in black and white. Behind the scenes, with every thank you that he gets, it's followed by a death threat. The photographer, Christopher Lee, says of Washington, D.C. police officer Mike Fanone, who appears on a cover of this issue of Time, and in an accompanying profile by national political correspondent Molly Ball. Following his recent testimony to Congress on the January 6 insurrection at the Capitol, I tried to show those conflicting feelings in the portrait, Lee says. Now, just below that, though, there's a colorful photo. It's a triptych photo of a doll. And the doll is dressed in scrubs, as if you would see this doll person standing in a hospital surgical suite. It's wearing dark blue scrubs and a light blue transparent jacket over the top, and it's got a scarf on, which may be serving as its mask. It's wearing black framed glasses and a scrub cap, if that's what they're called. Frontline Barbie, among a collection of Barbie-branded Mattel dolls honoring healthcare workers, is a likeness of Amy O'Sullivan, a Brooklyn nurse who appeared on a cover of the 2020 Time 100 issue, the list of the world's most influential people. For details, visit time.com/frontline-dolls and reread O'Sullivan's profile at time.com/Amy-O'Sullivan. Now to For the Record. It was an error to sign that law. I admit that. Stated by Asa Hutchinson, Republican governor of Arkansas, in an August 8 interview acknowledging regret over his approval of a law banning mask mandates in that state. A Code Red for Humanity by Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, in an August 9 statement after the release of an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that found the opportunity to limit the impact of climate change is rapidly narrowing. 340,000, that's 340,000, number of students across the U.S. who are expected to attend public school kindergartens starting in fall 2020, but did not, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, according to government data published by the New York Times, August 7. He always protected others, he just did not protect himself, by Vasina Zholudz, partner of Belarusian dissident Vitaly Shishov. In an August 5 interview, Shishov was found dead August 3 in Ukraine, in what European Parliament members have since said looks like a political killing. I didn't want to leave, but I have to, and I want to keep winning. That's my mentality, stated by Lionel Messi in a tearful August 8 press conference confirming his exit from the Spanish soccer team FC Barcelona after 21 years with the club. August 11, Messi signed with French team Paris Saint-Germain. More and more I find bathing to be less necessary. Jake Gyllenhaal discussing his hygiene habits in an August 5 interview with Vanity Fair. $5,800, value of a bottle of Japanese whiskey gifted to then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in 2019. The whiskey has since gone missing, according to an August 5 notice from the State Department. Good news of the week. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services will permit non-biological and non-gestational parents to pass their U.S. citizenship to their children born abroad as of August 5, in a win for LGBTQ families, among others. From the brief, it's the brief opener. It's headlined Health. It's subtitled The World Beyond Delta by Jamie Ducharme. Experts predicted from the start that the pandemic would end with a whimper, not a bang. That is, COVID-19 won't so much disappear as fade into the background, becoming like the other common infectious diseases that sicken people, but also can be controlled with vaccines and drugs. This can become a livable pathogen where it's there, it circulates. You're going to hear on the evening news about outbreaks in a dorm or movie theater, but people go about their normal lives. Former U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA Commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, predicted in an April 2020 interview with Time. For a while, it felt like the U.S. was closing in at that point. Highly effective vaccines made their way into millions of arms. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, relaxed its guidance on wearing face masks. By mid-June, the U.S. was recording an average of about 11,500 new cases each day, with deaths and hospitalizations falling commensurately. Businesses, schools, offices were preparing to reopen. Travel was rebounding, and life was feeling pretty normal. Then the highly transmissible Delta variant hit. The U.S. is now clocking around 100,000 new infections per day. Fewer people are dying or ending up in the hospital than at similar points during previous waves, but with only half the country fully vaccinated, millions in the U.S. remain vulnerable. The situation's grown bad enough that the CDC is again recommending that vaccinated people in certain areas wear masks indoors and many schools and offices are walking back just finalized reopening plans. Is this really what it feels like to live with COVID-19? There is only one human virus that the World Health Organization officially considers eradicated, the one that causes smallpox. It is more likely for a pathogen to instead become endemic, that is, part of life in a particular place. Endemic viruses circulate consistently and not without some disease and death, but they do not bring society to a screeching halt. That is the fate many experts see for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. There is no plausible way I can imagine us getting to zero COVID-19, says Dr. Sandro Galea, an epidemiologist and dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. A more realistic endpoint, he says, is for widespread immunity to make it so most people who get COVID-19 suffer no more than they would from a severe cold. The flu, for example, infects millions of people in the U.S. each year, but lands far fewer in the hospital and kills fewer still. Thanks to vaccines, Galea says, the U.S. is not so far from a similar situation with COVID-19. While death and hospitalization rates are dangerously high in states with low vaccine coverage, like Louisiana, the national picture is changing. About 125,000 people in the U.S. were diagnosed with COVID-19 August 6, and fewer than 600 died from it that day. On the same day last summer, by contrast, 60,000 new cases were diagnosed and more than 1,200 new deaths. There's a photo here. It looks like a large hall of some kind, a gym or a conference center or a convention center. The floors are concrete. Lots of tables are stationed diagonally from one another so that each is a few feet apart from the other. There are at least three chairs at each of the tables. About half the tables are filled with individuals, and about half of them are also supplied with bins of certain items. They are not labeled so that I can read them. But here's the caption. It says, people receive COVID-19 shots at a mass vaccination site in Seattle, March 13, 2021. So the place looks at least half busy, and it is bustling with activity. The people that I can see in the photo, it's like a bird's eye view. Someone's taking it from a higher point in a balcony or on a high ladder or scaffold. The people are wearing masks, and many of them are seated. Some are in wheelchairs. Others are standing, and it's indeterminate as to who might be the medical professional who's administering the shots and who are the patients, but there you go, it's a crowd getting vaccines. No vaccine's perfect, as was always expected. Some immunized people are experiencing breakthrough infections, which can, but rarely do, lead to serious illness. An analysis from the CDC also suggests vaccinated people who get infected with the Delta variant can infect others. But that does not mean the vaccines are not doing their job. They were designed to protect against severe disease and death, not infections. On that front, they're doing exceptionally well. Just 0.01% of fully vaccinated people in the U.S. have reported a breakthrough infection that led to severe disease, according to recent CDC data. Nevertheless, an obvious problem remains. About half the U.S. population still has not been vaccinated. That's not sustainable, says Dr. Vineet Arora, Dean for Medical Education at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. She finds the conversation about endemic COVID-19 premature. there are still tools in our toolbox we need to use before waving the white flag, Aurora says. That's A-R-O-R-A. For example, the FDA has yet to authorize vaccines for kids younger than 12. Leaving millions of children vulnerable. The three vaccines available in the U.S. right now have also received only emergency use authorization rather than FDA approval, a higher standard that involves a longer review process. Now, that bit of news has been preempted as of today with permanent authorization for one of the vaccines. If and when the FDA grants approval, Aurora says, it could boost confidence in the shots and make schools and workplaces feel better about requiring them. And though vaccine hesitancy has been discussed ad nauseum, many of the 30% of U.S. adults who remain unvaccinated are not anti-vaxxers. Surveys consistently show roughly 15% of U.S. adults say they will not get the vaccine under any circumstances. But that leaves another 15% in the gray area. Some still want to wait and see what happens to people who've already been vaccinated. A small percentage have medical conditions that prevent them from getting vaccinated. Others struggle to access vaccines because they do not have access to health care or cannot take time off from work or child care, Aurora says. Reaching those people can take lots of time and individual attention, but she says it can be done with targeted, culturally sensitive community outreach. Already people seem to be warming to vaccination as they see the impact of the Delta variant close to home. On average, more than 400,000 Americans are now getting their first dose each day, nearly double the daily average a month ago. But if the U.S. accepts COVID-19 as an unchangeable fact of life too soon, we are giving up on our children as well as people who already are living with structural inequities, Aurora says. Further, letting our guard down early could open the door to new variants even worse than Delta. The longer a virus spread, the more chances it has to mutate, potentially to the point that currently available vaccines no longer offer strong protection. The flu virus changes constantly, explains Catherine Zhu, XUE, a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University who studies viral evolution. It is that change that allows it to evade the buildup of immunity we acquire through our own previous infections, hence the need for annual flu shots. As SARS-CoV-2 mutates, it will likely get better at outsmarting the body's defenses. As with other viruses, you would likely experience subsequently milder illness with each exposure. But the more different the virus is, the more pressure it may place on those immune defenses, Zhu says. That is another argument for staying vigilant about COVID-19 prevention. As long as the virus is evolving, we have to evolve with it, Aurora says. That means resuming precautions like wearing masks indoors when conditions call for it and vaccinating as many people as quickly as possible. As long as the virus continues to circulate and mutate globally, there will be periodic spikes in infections. But if SARS-CoV-2 behaves like other similar viruses, these spikes should grow progressively milder, since a larger and larger chunk of the population will have immunity, either through vaccination or prior infection, each time it flares up. Eventually, it could become a disease that primarily affects young children, since everyone else would have had a brush with it before, says Jenny Lavine, L-A-V-I-N-E, a computational biologist who models infectious diseases at Atlanta's Emory University. If everyone 50 years from now is getting a first COVID-19 infection between the ages of 0 and 5, that would actually be lower disease burden than flu, Lavine notes, because kids, at least so far, have been less likely than adults to develop serious cases of COVID-19. It is possible, of course, that future variants could hit kids harder than initial strains, as already seems to be happening to some degree with Delta. Elderly adults and the immunocompromised will likely remain more vulnerable to COVID-19, meaning health officials will have to find ways to keep them safe. And there will probably continue to be people who develop long-lasting symptoms after even mild cases of COVID-19, a serious problem that demands more research and better treatments. None of those exceptions should be discounted. But in terms of living with COVID-19 at a population level, turning it into a disease that kills or hospitalizes far fewer people than it infects is the ideal scenario. There is never going to be a mission accomplished banner or an exact point when the virus becomes endemic, Xu says. It is going to be a very gradated move back toward normal life. Humanity's done this before. Viruses that routinely circulate today caused pandemics in the past. The point is not to minimize the suffering that occurred during those pandemics, but to recognize that the world eventually came out on the other side and that the same is possible for SARS-CoV-2. The View in large print, beneath which the world, and then the title, The Ones We Leave Behind, by Kimberly Dozier. An Afghan man I'll call Muhammad saved my life. It was 2001, just over 2 months since the September 11 attacks, when Muhammad drove me into Afghanistan as Kabul was falling. He spirited me through a Taliban checkpoint between Jalalabad and the capital, where an hour or so later, a car full of journalists were brutally killed. Muhammad found me, then a CBS News reporter, a safe place to stay in chaotic post-Taliban Kabul. That's what a fixer is for a foreign correspondent, part translator, part driver, part MacGyver. Every time I returned to the country, I would check on him and his family. And if I asked, he would drive me to hell and back. In 2015, three men beat and stabbed Muhammad's 18-year-old son, saying he was being punished because his father had worked for the Americans, Muhammad told me. He rushed his son to the hospital, then secreted his whole family to another part of the sprawling capital, always fearing the tap on the shoulder that meant he had been found. When he applied for the U.S. visa for Afghans who worked for the U.S. government, he was baffled to find he was not eligible. He had worked for an American, me, but not a soldier or diplomat. If that difference did not matter to the Taliban, he wondered, why should it matter to the U.S. government? As of August 2, Muhammad and hundreds like him are at last eligible for special visas, similar to those Washington's offered to the some 20,000 Afghans who worked for the U.S. government during the war. Multiple news outlets, including my former employer, CBS News, had petitioned the Biden administration to also help those Afghans who have worked with the U.S. media as journalists, interpreters, and support staff, and now fear retaliation from the Taliban. But here's the catch. The U.S. will not even start looking at Muhammad's application till he gets himself and his family out of Afghanistan. Unlike what's being offered to former U.S. government employees, there will be no special flights and no third country set aside where his family can wait safely. Processing applications could take more than a year with no guarantee of approval. Even this slim chance of a safe exit is not available to tens of thousands of Afghans now fleeing their homes. Militants have seized roughly two-thirds of the country, including nine provincial capitals as of August 11, with fierce fighting continuing. General Mark Milley, M-I-L-L-E-Y, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, admitted in late July that strategic momentum appears to be sort of with the Taliban. President Joe Biden says this war is now up to the Afghans, although the U.S. will continue to lend financial, humanitarian, even some air support. His military commanders insist a Taliban takeover is not a given. Milley also said in July that some 300,000 Afghan security forces are just falling back to protect cities. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says it's the best his troops can do because of the rapid U.S. withdrawal set to finish August 31 and what he called an imported, hasty peace process. From Biden's perspective, the calculation's simple. Many in both political parties and most Americans want out. So do many men and women who serve there. Nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and more than 3,800 U.S. private security contractors died in the war, per the Associated Press. More than 100,000 Afghan civilians have died in the conflict, according to the UN. The U.S. has spent in the region of $2 trillion, and still counting, on the conflict. It is the most comprehensive failure in my lifetime, one former senior Army officer told me. For Afghans, navigating the past two decades has meant near daily choices of loyalty. Those who chose the Americans and the Western-backed government now fear a bloody payback. Reports are flying on social media of Afghan commandos allegedly executed by Taliban forces, women forced to marry Taliban fighters, and the return of medieval punishments like stoning and beheading in areas now under Taliban control. The incidents are nearly impossible for U.S. diplomats on lockdown in Kabul to verify or deny. Many Afghans believe them. Muhammad understands what and who is coming. Driving me from Jalalabad to Kabul in 2001, or rather riding a taxi because a warlord had stolen our car, he spotted the impromptu checkpoint of armed, black-turbaned men standing on either side of the road. Muhammad spoke quietly but urgently to the driver, who floored it past the group before they could spot me in the back. By the time they did, we had torn past them around a mountain corner out of sight. That kind of violent random threat is what Muhammad fears most today. Now living in Afghanistan is very dangerous, he says. Secretary of State Antony Blinken extolled the virtues of expanding the visa program to more Afghans like Muhammad. They stood with us. We will stand with them, he told reporters. Muhammad may make it out, but what about every other Afghan left behind who risks their life by believing in my country? The author Dozier, that's Kimberly Dozier, is a Time contributor and Observer Research Foundation America visiting fellow. Here's a very small article, Leadership Brief, Where America Moves. The July 21 front page of the Billings Gazette included the following stories. A local man used a bow and arrow to catch a world record paddlefish, 92 pounds. Searchers reported a possible sighting, which proved false, of a missing hiker. But the lead story was on the housing boom sweeping the nation and its impact on Montana's biggest city. Billings' real estate market ranks hottest in the country, the newspaper declared, citing a Wall Street Journal index which ranked Billings as the number one emerging housing market. Billings Mayor Bill Cole, a graduate of Dartmouth College, has a theory on why people are moving to town. The 2020 election cycle was unusually brutal and divisive, he said. I think it is possible, although I don't have data, that some significant portion of the trend toward smaller cities has been from the coasts, from blue states to red states. It's people seeking out other people who think more like them. where they feel more comfortable, culturally and politically, he added. Places like Montana are going to be perceived to be further to the right, more red, and that has certain attractions for some. That article was written by Eben Shapiro, and there's a very small inset photo that accompanies it. There's a blue sky in the background and concrete in the front, and there are little U-Haul trailers parked in rows. And the caption reads, Billings is a top destination for Americans on the move. Next to that article is the Risk Report, Tunisia's Chaotic Dance with Democracy. This is by Ian Bremmer. Tunisia has carried an especially heavy burden over the past decade. It was the first country to cast out a longtime dictator as part of the Arab Spring revolts, and it's the only one where democracy established a lasting foothold. But all that is now in jeopardy because political pluralism has unleashed new waves of corruption, and political instability has destabilized a once strong economy. Now comes a constitutional crisis as a president who claims to act on behalf of Tunisia's people has grabbed power. Over the past decade, living standards in Tunisia have fallen. A fragmented political class has prevented the country from developing any sense of direction. A series of coalition governments have come and gone in quick succession. New crooks have staked claims to pieces of the country's wealth. Public frustration with corruption has only increased. Tunisia's economy has grown by an average of just 1.8% per year since the Arab Spring to 2019. Terrorist attacks that targeted tourists, a vital source of economic growth, then the pandemic, which dropped the GDP by 8.8% in 2020, have made matters much worse. Only about 12% of Tunisia's 12 million people have been fully vaccinated, and there's been a recent surge of Tunisians immigrating to Italy. In 2019, fed-up Tunisians elected as president a little-known political outsider named Kais Saied. That's K-I-I-S, space, K-A-I-S, space, the last name S-A-I-E-D. 2 weeks ago, Saied, a former professor of constitutional law, who had clearly decided he had seen enough of Tunisia's political mess, fired Prime Minister Hichem Mehichi, and suspended parliament for 30 days. He also announced his own war on corruption after granting himself the powers of the state prosecutor. Opposition leaders have denounced these moves as a coup, and demonstrators on both sides of the issue have taken to the street. Saied is not exactly charismatic. He is known jokingly as Robocop, because he speaks in a soporific monotone. Yet, a recent local poll found 84% of Tunisians surveyed approved of Saied's power grab. It is just the latest example of a transition to democracy that creates enough chaos to build public support for a strong man. In neighboring Egypt, Hosni Mubarak was shoved aside in 2011 in favor of elections that briefly brought to power the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi in 2012, but Morsi was toppled by a military coup after just 1 year in power. Further afield, many of the Russians who cheered Boris Yeltsin's bid to create an independent Russia found democracy was not what they hoped for. A suddenly unshackled press was free to report on the frightening hyperinflation, unemployment, and official corruption that left many Russians eager for a restoration of order. Since Vladimir Putin assumed power 2 decades ago, Russia has become a democracy in name only. It is far too early to know if Tunisia is headed in a similar direction. The more immediate danger for Tunisia is its democracy and constitution are too untested to provide a clear path forward out of this crisis that the opposition can accept. Said claims he has a mandate to rule by decree till he appoints a new prime minister. The largest opposition group, the moderate religious Ennahda Party, claims the number of seats it won in the most recent parliamentary elections gives it the right to choose who will lead the next government. The Constitution says this issue must be resolved by a special court, but it does not specify who is allowed to sit on that court. For now, Kais Saied is in charge, but unless he delivers the sense of security and hope he's promised, the goodwill won't last. Ian Bremmer wrote, Tunisia's chaotic dance with democracy. Now we might get to the bottom of that cover photo of four individuals looking like they're in space suits. Space is the subject, the next frontier. And it's all spelled out that way, the next frontier, by Jeffrey Kluger. Here are the people in the cover photograph, posed slightly differently, but still wearing those same dark spacesuits. The caption reads, "The women and men of Inspiration 4 will be the first all-civilian crew to fly in space, spending 3 days in orbit." Okay, we've got that far. I may abridge this article. It's quite lengthy. I'll start by reading the captions on the portraits of each of these space people. Jared Isaacman, 38, the commander of Inspiration 4. Isaacman is founder and CEO of Shift 4, and the 4 is a numeral, Payments, an online payment company. He's also founder of Draken, D-R-A-K-E-N, International, the world's largest private air force. Now, he does have this black suit on, that is a space suit, kind of coverall thing. The U.S. flag is in black and white, positioned on the left arm. On the right arm, there's a badge that says St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. On the front left side is a badge that says Jared Rook Isaacman with the flight wings insignia. And on the right front of that suit is a circular emblem that says Inspiration, probably Inspiration 4. I can't read it all. Now, on the verso of that page, Haley Arsenault, 29, a survivor of childhood cancer. Arsenault, this is a woman, now works at St. Jude Research Hospital in Memphis. She'll be the first person to fly in space with a prosthesis, an artificial femur, to replace the bone she lost to her disease. And then there's Chris Sembroski, 41, a veteran of the Iraq War. Sembroski's now an engineer with Lockheed Martin in Everett, Washington. He'll serve as mission specialist on Inspiration 4, responsible for cargo and some experiments. Now, they're also wearing the dark, what I think is black, space suits, coveralls, with the flag insignia and the St. Jude insignia and the name. And we're still missing one person. Let's see if her photo's coming up. Yep, here it is. And it's, I don't know how it's pronounced, S-I-A-N. It might be Shion Proctor, 51. Proctor, and this is a woman, Proctor has tried to get to space before, having applied to be a NASA astronaut. In 2009, she made it to the final 47 out of an applicant class of more than 3,500. Now, returning to the text, which I will probably abbreviate, Jared Isaacman is not likely to forget the day he almost died at 10,000 feet back in 2011. Again, this is written by Jeffrey Kluger. He was flying closely alongside three others, all in L-39 fighter jets, tearing along at 460 miles per hour over the desert southwest of Las Vegas. The group, part of Isaacman's Black Diamonds acrobatic team, was rehearsing for an air show and trying to come up with a flashy new finish. What they decided on called for flying in a square formation, then suddenly veering toward one another before pulling back at the last second. It would be a nifty thing to watch go right and a terrible thing to watch go wrong. The pilots began the maneuver at their four separate corners, then banked in toward one another, but their coordination was a mess, and the fully fueled fighter jets came screaming toward one another. "Holy SHT," exclaimed Isaacman over the radio. He yanked hard on his stick and veered sharply away. The others did the same. Shortly afterward, the Black Diamonds landed, gathered to debrief, and reached three conclusions. First, they'd gotten too close during the critical approach point. Second, the cause was most likely insufficient lateral spacing at the beginning. Third, they would never try such a high-stakes stunt again. Then they relaxed and laughed. "When you survive, you can joke about it later," Isaacman says. "After we debriefed, we were imagining if you were just a hiker in the desert looking up and you're like, 'Oh, look at that.' And then you see this collision. It would be most unusual." Most unusual is a decidedly understated way to describe one's own near-death experience, but Isaacman, now 38 and the billionaire CEO of Shift 4 Payments, an online payment company, as well as the founder of Draken International, a company that runs what's effectively the world's largest private air force, has always prided himself on a certain sang-froid. He needed it that day in 2011, and he'll need it again September 15, when he is set to once again be part of a team of four trying something very daring. This time, Isaacman's crew will not be flying at 10,000 feet, but a projected 360 miles up, higher than the Hubble Space Telescope. This time there won't be four vehicles, just one, a SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft. And this time the flyers won't be moving at 460 miles per hour, but at 17,500 miles per hour, launched into space atop a 215-foot-tall SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. The mission, dubbed Inspiration 4, will mark the first time an all-civilian, non-governmental crew has taken to orbit. To make the mission possible, Isaacman bought all four seats aboard the Dragon for an undisclosed sum, likely in the vicinity of $50 million each. And if he has his way, it will begin to democratize space in a way never before possible. Okay, we're going to democratize space at $50 million a seat. That was an editorial comment for which I apologize. I have just invited a bunch of my pilot buddies to go, and we would have had a great time and come back and had a bunch of cocktails, Isaacman said. Instead, we wanted to bring in everyday people and energize everyone else around the idea of opening up spaceflight to more and more of us. Isaacman's mission will be the capstone of what has been America's summer of civilian spaceflight. July 11, Virgin Galactic founder Richard Branson flew aboard his VSS Unity space plane more than 50 miles high over New Mexico, crossing the boundary that the U.S. military considers the threshold of space. July 20, Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos bested Branson flying aboard his new Shepard spacecraft above the 62-mile-high mark over Texas, crossing the so-called Von Karman line, the altitude that most experts consider space's true boundary. There's been much media sizzle around the Branson and Bezos missions, not least because of the billionaire space race headlines. But in fact, the pair did not do a whole lot. Their flights were little more than 10-minute up-and-down suborbital lob shots. By contrast, Isaacman and his crew will spend 3 days in orbit, doing real science on a real mission. The SpaceX Dragon is largely automated, but as Isaacman puts it, it's a multi-day orbital mission, and there's just a lot of time for things to go wrong. So, The Inspiration 4 crew has been in intensive training in case anything indeed goes wrong. For the Inspiration 4 crew, the past 5 months have been a flat-out sprint to their planned September launch. Isaacman, who assigned himself the position of commander, wants a tight, professional, prepared crew. He personally designed part of the training program, which in part called for flying each crew member in his Soviet MiG-29, exposing them to the kinds of G-forces they'll experience during liftoff and reentry. Also on the agenda was a two-day hike up to 10,000 feet on Mount Rainier in Washington State this past April. "We got snowed on a lot of the way," says Arsenault, the St. Jude physician assistant, who made the hike despite her prosthetic femur. "And our ham and cheese sandwiches wound up frozen." "The constant plodding upward really did me in," says Sembroski, the engineer. "My legs were on fire." That, in some ways, was the whole idea. "We want to get comfortable with being uncomfortable," Isaacman says. "A lot of things in the spacecraft will be uncomfortable, after all." The rest of their training has mostly involved the usual NASA-style simulator and classroom work, only on a compressed timeline. On a recent day at SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne, California, the crew practiced opening and closing the hatch. What to do in the event of a pressure leak in the hatch seal. Techniques for Earth observation, splashdown, recovery procedures, and that was all before lunch. "I'm used to doing things on NASA time, which gives you 2 years to train for a mission," says Proctor. "We have from March to September." Isaacman is confident. "You just accept there's a very, very low probability of something going wrong," he says. He should know. He's come back from harrowing flying before, and space, he's convinced, is an order of magnitude safer than air shows. His concern, he says, is more about performance. If Inspiration 4 will not, in fact, kick the door to space travel wide open, allowing the rest of us to pour through after it, it can at least crack that door, coming just a little closer to normalizing rocket travel and democratizing space. For Isaacman, that carries with it not just a responsibility to his crew, but to history to get the mission right. "I am constantly thinking about good execution," he says. "We have to fly well. We have to earn the right to be here." That article was abridged, and here is another short half-page article, History, 4 Decades of Civilian Spaceflight, by Olivia B. Waxman. It has been 52 years since Jeff Gates booked lunar passage via Pan Am's First Moon Flights Club, a marketing stunt from the now-defunct airline. Like thousands of other would-be astronauts, he made his reservation after watching NASA's Apollo 11 astronauts land on the moon. But he did not think much about his ticket till the Space Shuttle Challenger broke apart shortly after liftoff in 1986, killing all 7 aboard, including Krista McAuliffe, who would have been the first teacher in space. That's when Gates, now 52, realized commercial space travel is not going to be normalized anytime soon, as he put it. But Gates has been watching in recent weeks as a series of civilian space missions, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic flight, Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin launch, and the upcoming Inspiration 4 mission are bringing his space dreams ever closer to reality. Still, this summer, civilian launches are just the latest in a long history of private citizens blasting into space. Civilians have been joining highly trained astronauts for nearly 4 decades, a mixture of politicians who had power over NASA's budget, people selected as publicity stunts or in the name of diplomacy, and billionaires with plenty of cash to burn. Among the first non-traditional astronauts to fly was Senator Jake Garn, Republican, Utah, a former chair of the subcommittee charged with overseeing NASA's budget. He once joked that the agency wouldn't get another cent unless they let him go to space. NASA granted his wish in 1985 when he flew aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. NASA's spaceflight participant program, an effort to launch teachers, journalists, and other storytellers and influencers, soon followed, though it was scrapped after the Challenger disaster. The title of first space tourist, however, is generally agreed to belong to Dennis Tito, T-I-T-O, a financial entrepreneur who in 2001 paid a reported $20 million for a trip to the International Space Station, ISS, aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket. Tito's trip came as Moscow's space program was bleeding cash, leading Russia to throw open its doors to people with enough money to make the journey. Other space tourists followed Tito, including telecom entrepreneur Anoushe Ansari, video game developer Richard Garriott, and software billionaire Charles Simonyi, who notably is the only space tourist to have made repeat trips, flying in 2007 and again in 2009. Now, with the rise of U.S.-based private space companies like Virgin Galactic, Blue Origin, and Elon Musk's SpaceX, civilians with a hankering to blast themselves into space no longer need to travel to the remote desert steppe of Baikonur, Kazakhstan, for a ride aboard a Russian rocket. It is still early days for all three companies, none of which has announced formal plans for another civilian launch. But for Gates and other civilians dreaming of a trip to the stars, their ship may come in and blast off soon enough. Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, Elon Musk should make good my ticket to the moon, says Gates. From the page entitled Six Questions, and this is written by Katie Lang, there's a photo here of a dignified-looking woman dressed in a dark pantsuit. She has dark hair. She's Caucasian. She has dark lipstick. She has dark-rimmed glasses. She has pearls around her neck. And around her, on top of her collar, she's wearing a wide white, or at least white-colored ribbon with a big medal attached. Billie Jean King, the tennis legend on athlete struggles with mental health, the fight for equal pay, and her new memoir, All In. In your book, this is the question you write, even if you're not a born activist, life can damn sure make you one. How did you come to this conclusion? Billie Jean King's answer. When I was 12 years old, I had my epiphany. I started playing tournaments to get rankings in Southern California. Everybody who played wore white shoes and white socks, white clothes, played with white balls. Everybody that played was white. And I remember saying, "Where's everybody else?" I just knew if I ever could become number one, I would champion equality the rest of my life. But I knew I had to probably be number one because I knew already at 12 years old, I was a second-class citizen and I'm white. I knew my sisters of color had it tougher. I knew that others had it tougher, people living with disabilities. Question you wrote about how black tennis star Althea Gibson helped shape the way you saw your future. Your path has provided a way for many young people to see themselves. What do you think the importance of visibility is? I think you have a chance to make answer. I think you have a chance to make a bigger impact because you are reaching more people. I think people have to realize if you hear our stories, women's stories, black stories, brown stories, when you start to hear stories of people as human beings, not that they had a good forehand or backhand, that's what's interesting to people. Question, as a pioneer in women's professional sports, you often received backlash for speaking out. What do you think of athletes using their platforms to promote social change? Answer, it's always good to hear people and their opinions. You don't have to agree with them, but it makes you think, or maybe it's a wake-up call and you didn't realize it. With it, though, there's responsibility. If you look at the history of how pro tennis started in '68 and how women were getting shut out, We signed this $1 contract that's the birth of women's professional tennis the way you know it today. We were all very young at the time. We decided we were willing to give up our careers. We were willing to give up everything for future generations. Question, it does feel like a very different time now when athletes might be overexposed. I'm thinking specifically about Naomi Osaka, who recently declined to do media because of her mental health. Answer, I know it's difficult, but I think we need to do a better job of having a rookie school. Because I think if you choose to be a professional athlete, that does not mean you just hit tennis balls. I mean, you're going to have to talk to somebody sometime. Question, what does it feel like to see the work that still needs to be done when it comes to pay equity? Answer, for me, it's not even close yet, and I'm so frustrated because I'm really running out of time. Question, what do you think needs to happen so we can actually achieve pay equity now for sports, but also in general? Answer, sports are a microcosm of society. Let me ask you, do women writers make as much as male writers? Question, well, personally, I've been meaning to ask for a raise. Answer, girls are taught not to do that. Go for it. At least you've been asking. My generation never asked, but you know what? Women want the cake and the icing and the cherry on top, just like everybody else, and we have to go for it. The six questions were briefly abridged to five, but we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.